Urge were the only two scatterees, as a matter of fact, and that was when they had begun their new lives as zookeepers. Garvey had come along on the 1st of July and Ronnie on the 3rd. At that point, they had closed their peculiar little club to further memberships.
"But after a while you must have outnumbered them," Glenn said.
Unexpectedly, it was Shirley Hammett who spoke to this.
"Pills," she said,
her trapped mice eyes staring out at them from behind the fringe of her graying bangs.
"Pills every morning to get up, pills every night to go down. Ups and downs."
Her voice had been sinking, and this last was barely audible. She paused, then began to mutter again. Susan Stern took up the thread of the story. She and one of the dead women, Rachel Carmody, had been picked up on July 17th outside Columbus. By then the party was traveling in a caravan which consisted of two station wagons and the wrecker. The men used the wrecker to move crashed vehicles out of their way or to roadblock the highway, depending on what opportunities offered. Doc kept the pharmacy tied to his belt in an outsized poke. Heavy downers for bedtime, tranks for travel, reds for recess.
"I'd get up in the morning, be raped two or three times, and then wait for Doc to hand out the pills," Susan said matter-of-factly. "The daytime pills, I mean. By the third day I had abrasions on my, well, you know, my vagina, and any sort of normal intercourse was very painful. I used to hope for Ronnie because all Ronnie ever wanted was a blowjob. But after the pills, you got very calm. Not sleepy, just calm. Things didn't seem to matter after you got yourself wrapped around a few of those blue pills. All you wanted to do was sit with your hands in your lap and watch the scenery go by, or sit with your hands in your lap and watch them use the record to move something out of the way. One day Garvey got mad because this one girl, she couldn't have been more than 12, she wouldn't do, well, I'm not going to tell you. It was that bad. So Garvey blew her head off. I didn't even care. I was just calm. After a while you almost stopped thinking about escape. What you wanted more than getting away was those blue pills." Dana and Patty Kroger were nodding. "But they seemed to recognize 8 women as their effective limit," Patty said. "When they took her on July 22nd after murdering the 50-ish man she had been traveling with, they had killed a very old woman who had been a part of the zoo for about a week. When the unnamed girl sitting in the corner had been picked up near Archbold, a 16-year-old girl with strabismus had been shot and left in a ditch." "Doc used to joke about it," Patty said. "He'd say, 'I don't walk under ladders, I don't cross black cats' paths, and I'm not going to have 13 people traveling with me.'"
On the 29th, they had caught sight of Stu and the others for the first time. The zoo had been camped in a picnic area just off the interstate when the 4 of them passed by.
"Garvey was very taken with you," Susan said, nodding toward Franny. Franny shuddered.
Dana leaned closer to them and spoke softly.
"And they'd made it pretty clear whose place you were going to take."
She nodded her head almost imperceptibly at Shirley Hammett, who was still muttering and eating graham crackers.
"That poor woman," Franny said.
"It was Dana who decided you guys might be our best chance," Patty said. "Or maybe our last chance. There were 3 men in your party. Both she and Helen Rodgett had seen that. 3 armed men. And Doc had gotten just the teeniest bit overconfident about the trailer overturned in the road bit. Doc would just act like somebody official, and the men in the parties they met, when there were men, just caved in and got shot. It had been working like a charm."
"Dana asked us to try and palm our pills this morning," Susan went on. "They'd gotten sort of careless about making sure we really took them, too, and we knew that this morning they'd be busy pulling that big trailer out into the road and tipping it over. We didn't tell everyone. The only ones in on it were Dana and Patty and Helen Rodgett, one of the girls Ronnie shot back there, and me, of course. Helen said, 'If they catch us trying to spit the pills into our hands, they're going to kill us.' And Dana said they would kill us anyway, sooner or later, and only sooner if we were lucky. And of course we knew that was true, so we did it."
"I had to hold mine in my mouth for quite a while," Patty said. "It was starting to dissolve by the time I got a chance to spit it out." She looked at Dana. "I think Helen actually had to swallow hers. I think that's why she was so slow."
Dana nodded.
She was looking at Stu with a clear warmth that made Franny uneasy.
It still would have worked if you hadn't gotten wise, big fella.
I didn't get wise near soon enough, looks like, Stu said. Next time I will.
He stood up, went to the window, and looked out.
You know, that's half of what scares me, he said. How wise we're all getting.
Fran cared even less for the sympathetic way Dana looked after him. She had no right to look sympathetic after all she'd been through. And she's much prettier than I am, in spite of everything, Fran thought. Also, I doubt if she's pregnant.
It's a get-wise world, big fella, Dana said. Get wise or die.
Stu turned to look at her, really seeing her for the first time, and Fran felt a stab of pure jealous agony. I waited too long, she thought. Oh, my God, I went and did it. I went and waited too long. She happened to glance at Harold and saw that Harold was smiling in a guarded way, one hand up to his mouth to conceal it. It looked like a smile of relief. She suddenly felt that she would like to stand up, walk casually over to Harold, and hook his eyes out of his head with her fingernails. Never, Harold, she would scream as she did it. Never!
Never?
From Fran Goldsmith's diary. July 19th, 1990. Oh, Lord, the worst has happened. At least in the books when it happens, it's over. Something at least changes. But in real life, it just seems to go on, like a soap opera where nothing ever comes to a head. Maybe I should move to clear things up, take a chance, but I'm so afraid something might happen between them, and, well, you can't end a sentence with and, but I'm afraid to put down what might come after the conjunction. Let me tell you everything, dear diary, even though it's no great treat to write it down. I even hate to think about it. Glenn and Stu went into town, which happens to be Girard, Ohio, tonight, near dusk, to look for some food, hopefully concentrates and freeze-dried stuff. They're easy to carry, and some of the concentrates are really tasty, but as far as I'm concerned, all the freeze-dried food has the same flavor, namely dried turkey turds. And when have you ever had dried turkey turds to serve as your basis for a comparison? Never mind, diary, some things will never be told, ha-ha. They asked Harold and me if we wanted to come, but I said I'd had enough motorcycling for one day, if they could do without me. And Harold said no, he would fetch some water and get it boiled up. Probably already laying his plans. Sorry to make him sound so scheming, but the simple fact is, he is. A note here. We are all fantastically sick of boiled water, which tastes flat and totally devoid of oxygen. But both Mark and Glenn say the factories, etc., have not been shut down nearly long enough for the streams and rivers to have purified themselves, especially in the industrial Northeast and what they call the Rust Belt. So we all boil to be safe. We all keep hoping we'll find a large supply of bottled mineral water sooner or later, and should have already, so Harold says, but a lot of it seems to have mysteriously disappeared. Stu thinks that a lot of people must have decided it was the tap water that was making them sick, and used up a lot of mineral water before they died. Well, Mark and Perrion were off somewhere, supposedly hunting for wild berries to supplement our diet, probably doing something else. They are quite modest about it, and bully for them, say I. And so I was first gathering wood for a fire, and then getting one going for Harold's kettle of water. And pretty soon he came back with one. He'd pretty obviously stayed at the stream long enough to have a bath and wash his hair. He hung it on the what-do-you-call-it that goes over the fire. Then he comes and sits down beside me. We were sitting on a log, talking about one thing and another, when he suddenly put his arms around me and tried to kiss me. I say tried, but he actually succeeded, at least at first, because I was so surprised. Then I jerked away from him. Looking back, it seems sort of comic, although I'm still sore, and fell backward right off the log. It rucked up the back of my blouse and scraped about a yard of skin off. I let out a yell. Talk about history repeating. That was too much like the time with Jess out on the breakwater when I bit my tongue. Too much like it for comfort. In a second, Harold's on one knee beside me, asking if I'm all right, blushing right down to the roots of his clean hair. Harold tries sometimes to be so icy, so sophisticated. He always seems to me like a jaded young writer constantly searching for that special sad cafe on the West Bank, where he can idle the day away talking about Jean-Paul Sartre and drinking cheap Planck. But underneath, well covered, is a teenager with a far less mature set of fantasies. Or so I believe. Saturday matinee fantasies, for the most part. Tyrone Power in Captain from Castile, Humphrey Bogart in Dark Passage, Steve McQueen in Bullet. In times of stress, it's always this side of him which seems to come out, maybe because he repressed it so severely as a child. I don't know. Anyway, when he regresses to Bogey, he only succeeds in reminding me of that guy who played Bogey in that Woody Allen movie, Play It Again, Sam. So when he knelt beside me and said, "Are you all right, baby?" I started to giggle. Talk about history repeating itself. But it was more than the humor of the situation, you know. If that had been all, I could have held it in. No, it was more in the line of hysterics. The bad dreams, the worrying about the baby, what to do about my feelings for Stu, the traveling every day, the stiffness, the soreness, losing my parents, everything changed for good. It came out in giggles at first, then in hysterical laughter I just couldn't stop. "What's so funny?" Harold asked, getting up. I think it was supposed to come out in this terribly righteous voice, but by then I had stopped thinking about Harold and got this crazy image of Donald Duck in my head. Donald Duck waddling through the ruins of Western civilization, quacking angrily, "What's so funny, huh? What's so funny? What's so fucking funny?" I put my hands over my face and just giggled and sobbed and giggled until Harold must have thought I'd gone absolutely crackers. After a little bit, I managed to stop. I wiped the tears off my face and wanted to ask Harold to look at my back and see how badly it was scraped. But I didn't because I was afraid he might take it as a liberty. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of Franny. Oh ho, that's not so funny. "Fran," Harold says, "I find this very hard to say." "Then maybe you better not say it," I said. "I have to," he answers, and I began to see he wasn't going to take no for an answer unless it was hollered at him. "Franny," he says, "I love you." I guess I knew all along it was just as bald as that. It would be easier if he only wanted to sleep with me. Love's more dangerous than just bawling, and I was in a spot. How to say no to Harold? I guess there's only one way, no matter who you have to say it to. "I don't love you, Harold," is what I said. His face cracked all to pieces. "It's him, isn't it?" he said, and his face got an ugly grimace on it. "It's Stu Redman, isn't it?" "I don't know," I said. Now, I have a temper which I have not always been able to control, a gift from my mother's side, I think. But I have struggled womanfully with it as applies to Harold. I could feel it straining its leash, however. "I know," his voice had gotten shrill and self-pitying. "I know, all right. The day we met him, I knew it then. I didn't want him to come with us because I knew. And he said..." "What did he say?" "That he didn't want you, that you could be mine. Just like giving you a new pair of shoes, right, Harold?" He didn't answer, maybe realizing he had gone too far. With a little effort, I remembered back to that day in Fabian. Harold's instant reaction to Stu was the reaction of a dog when a new dog, a strange dog, comes into the first dog's yard, into his domain. I could almost see the hackles bristling on the back of Harold's neck. I understood that what Stu said, he said it to take us out of the class of dogs and put us back in the class of people. And isn't that what it's really all about? This hellacious struggle we're in now, I mean? If it isn't, why are we even bothering to try and be decent? "No one owns me, Harold," I said. He muttered something. "What?" I said, "You may have to change that idea." A sharp retort came to mind, but I didn't let it out. Harold's eyes had gone far away, and his face was very still and open. He said, "I've seen that guy before. You better believe it, Franny. He's the guy that's the quarterback on the football team, but who just sits there in class throwing spitballs and flipping people the bird because he knows the teacher's got to pass him with at least a C so he can keep on playing. He's the guy who goes steady with the prettiest cheerleader and she thinks he's Jesus Christ with a bullet. The guy who farts when the English teacher asks you to read your composition because it's the best one in the class. Yeah, I know fuckers like him. Good luck, Fran." Then he just walked off. It wasn't the grand trampling exit he'd meant to make, I feel quite sure. It was more like he'd had some secret dream, and I'd just shot it full of holes. The dream being that things had changed, the reality being that nothing really had. I felt terrible for him, God's truth, because when he walked off he wasn't playing at jaded cynicism, but feeling real cynicism. Not jaded, but as sharp and hurtful as a knife blade. He was whipped. Oh, but what Harold will never see is that his head has got to change a little first. He's got to see that the world is going to stay the same as long as he does. He stores up rebuffs the way pirates were supposed to store up treasure. Well, now everyone is back, supper eaten, smokes smoked, Varen all handed out, mine is in my pocket instead of dissolving in my mouth, people settling down. Harold and I have gone through a painful confrontation which has left me with the feeling that nothing has really been resolved, except that he is watching Stu and me to see what happens next. It makes me feel sick and pointlessly angry to write that. What right does he have to watch us? What right does he have to complicate this miserable situation we are in? Things to remember. I'm sorry, diary, it must be my state of mind. I can't remember a single thing.
When Franny came upon him, Stu was sitting on a rock and smoking a cigar. He had scraped a small round circle of bare earth with his boot heel and was using it for an ashtray. He was facing west, where the sun was just going down. The clouds had rifted enough to allow the red sun to poke its head through. Although they had met the four women and taken them into their party only yesterday, it already seemed distant. They had gotten one of the station wagons out of the ditch easily enough, and now, with the motorcycles, they made quite a caravan as they moved slowly west on the turnpike. The smell of his cigar made her think of her father and her father's pipe. What came with the memory was sorrow that had almost mellowed into nostalgia. "I'm getting over losing you, Daddy," she thought. "I don't think you'd mind." Stu looked around. "Franny," he said with real pleasure, "how are you?" She shrugged. "Up and around. Want to share my rock and watch the sun go down?" She joined him, her heartbeat quickening a little. But after all, why else had she come out here? She had known which way he left camp, just as she knew that Harold and Glenn and two of the girls had gone into Brighton to look for a CB radio. Glenn's idea instead of Harold's for a change. Patty Kroger was back in camp babysitting their two combat fatigue patients. Shirley Hammett showed some signs of coming out of her daze, but she had awakened them all around one this morning, shrieking in her sleep, her hands clawing at the air in warding-off gestures. The other woman, the one with no name, seemed to be going in the other direction. She sat. She would eat if she was fed. She would perform the functions of elimination. She would not answer questions. She only really came alive in her sleep. Even with a heavy dose of Varenol, she often moaned and sometimes shrieked. Franny thought she knew what the poor woman was dreaming of. "It seems like a long way still to go, doesn't it?" she said. He didn't answer for a moment, and then he said, "It's further than we thought. That old woman, she's not in Nebraska anymore."
"I know," she began, and then bit down on her words.
He glanced at her with a faint grin. "You've been skipping your medication, ma'am."
"My secret's out," she said with a lame smile.
"We're not the only ones," Stu said. "I was talking to Dana this afternoon." She felt that interior dig of jealousy and fear at the familiar way he used her name. "And she said neither she nor Susan wanted to take it."
Fran nodded. "Why did you stop? Did they drug you in that place?"
He tapped ashes into his bare-earth ashtray. "Mild sedatives at night, that was all. They didn't need to drug me. I was locked up nice and tight. No, I stopped 3 nights ago because I felt out of touch."
He meditated for a moment and then expanded.
"Glenn and Harold going to get that CB radio. That was a real good idea. What's a two-way for? To put you in touch. This buddy of mine back in Arnett, Tony Leominster, he had one in his scout. Great gadget.
You could talk to folks, or you could holler for help if you got in a jam of trouble. These dreams, they're almost like having a CB in your head, except the transmit seems to be broken and we're only receiving.
Maybe we are transmitting, Fran said quietly.
He looked at her, startled. They sat quiet for a while. The sun peered through the clouds as if to say a quick goodbye before sinking below the horizon. Fran could understand why primitive people worshipped it. As the gigantic quiet of the nearly empty country accumulated on her day by day, imprinting its truth on her brain by its very weight, the sun, the moon too for that matter, began to seem bigger and more important, more personal. Those bright sky ships began to look to you as they had when you were a child.
"Anyway, I stopped," Stu said. "Last night I dreamed about that black man again. It was the worst yet. He's setting up somewhere out in the desert. Las Vegas, I think. And Franny, I think he's crucifying people, the ones who give him trouble."
"He's doing what?"
"That's what I dreamed. Lines of crosses along Highway 15 made out of barn beams and telephone poles. People hanging off them."
"Just a dream," she said uneasily.
"Maybe."
He smoked and looked west at the red-tinged clouds.
"But the other two nights, just before we run on those maniacs holding the women, I dreamed about her, the woman who calls herself Mother Abigail. She was sitting in the cab of an old pickup truck parked on the shoulder of Highway 76. I was standing on the ground with one arm leaning on the window, talking to her just as natural as I'm talking to you. And she says, 'You got to move 'em along faster still, Stuart. If an old lady like me can do it, a big tough fella from Texas like you should be able to.'"
Stu laughed, threw down his cigar, and crushed it under his heel. In kind of an absent way, as if not knowing what he was doing, he put an arm around Franny's shoulders.
"They're going to Colorado," she said.
"Why, yes, I think they are."
Has either Dana or Susan dreamed of her?"
"Both. And last night Susan dreamed of the crosses, just like I did."
"There's a lot of people with that old woman now."
Stu agreed. 20, maybe more. "You know, we're passing people nearly every day. They just hunker down and wait for us to go by. They're scared of us, but her, they'll come to her, I guess, in their own good time."
"Or to the other one," Franny said.
Stu nodded.
"Yeah, or to him. Fran, why did you stop taking the Veranol?"
She uttered a trembling sigh and wondered if she should tell him. She wanted to, but she was afraid of what his reaction might be.
"There's no counting on what a woman will do," she said at last.
"No," he agreed. "But there are ways to find out what they're thinking, maybe."
"What?" she began, and he stopped her mouth with a kiss.
They lay on the grass in the last of the twilight. Flagrant red had given way to cooler purple as they made love, and now Franny could see stars shining through the last of the clouds. It would be good riding weather tomorrow. With any luck, they would be able to get most of the way across Indiana. Stu slapped lazily at a mosquito hovering over his chest. His shirt was hung on a nearby bush. Fran's shirt was on, but unbuttoned. Her breasts pushed at the cloth, and she thought, "I'm getting bigger. Just a little right now, but it's noticeable, at least to me."
"I've wanted you for a pretty long time now," Stu said without looking directly at her.
"I guess you know that."
"I wanted to avoid trouble with Harold," she said. "And there's something else that—"
"Harold's got a ways to go," Stu said, "but he's got the makings of a fine man somewhere inside him if he'll toughen up. You like him, don't you?"
"That's not the right word. There isn't a word in English for how I feel about Harold."
"How do you feel about me?" he asked.
She looked at him and found she couldn't say she loved him, couldn't say it right out, although she wanted to.
"No," he said, as if she'd contradicted him. "I just like to get things straight. I guess you'd just as soon not have Harold know anything about this yet, isn't that right?"
"Yes," she said gratefully.
"It's just as well. If we lie low, it may take care of itself. I've seen him looking at Patty. She's about his age."
I don't know. You feel a debt of gratitude to him, don't you?
I suppose so. We were the only two left in the Gunquit, and
that was luck, no more, Franny. You don't want to let anyone put you in a head hold over something that was pure luck.
I suppose.
I guess I love you, he said. That's not so easy for me to say.
I guess I love you, too, but there's something else.
I knew that.
You asked me why I stopped taking the pills.
She plucked at her shirt, not daring to look at him. Her lips felt unnaturally dry.
I thought they might be bad for the baby, she whispered.
For the... He stopped. Then he grasped her and turned her to face him.
You're pregnant?
She nodded.
And you didn't tell anyone?
No.
Harold, does Harold know?
No one but you.
God almighty damn, he said.
He was peering into her face in a concentrated way that scared her. She had imagined one of two things. He would leave her immediately, as Jess undoubtedly would have done if he had discovered she was pregnant with another man's child. Or he would hug her, tell her not to worry, that he would take care of everything. She had never expected this startled, close scrutiny, and she found herself remembering the night she had told her father in the garden. His look had been very much like this one. She wished she had told Stu what her situation was before they had made love. Maybe then they wouldn't have made love at all, but at least he wouldn't have been able to feel he had somehow been taken advantage of, that she was, what was the old phrase, damaged goods. Was he thinking that? She simply could not tell.
Stu, she said in a frightened voice.
You didn't tell anyone, he repeated.
I didn't know how.
Her tears were close to the surface now.
When are you due?
January, she said, and the tears came. He held her and made her know it was all right without saying anything. He didn't tell her not to worry or that he would take care of everything, but he made love to her again, and she thought that she had never been so happy. Neither of them saw Harold, as shadowy and as silent as the dark man himself, standing in the bushes and looking at them. Neither of them knew that his eyes squinted down into small, deadly triangles as Fran cried out her pleasure at the end of it, as her good orgasm burst through her. By the time they had finished, it was full dark. Harold slipped away silently. From Fran Goldsmith's diary, August 1st, 1990. No entry last night. Too excited. Too happy. Stu and I are together. He has agreed that I'd better keep the secret of my Lone Ranger as long as possible, hopefully until we are settled. If it's to be Colorado, that's okay with me. The way I feel tonight, the Mountains of the Moon would be okay with me. Do I sound like a dizzy schoolgirl? Well, if a lady can't sound like a dizzy schoolgirl in her diary, where can she sound like one? But I must say one other thing before I drop the subject of the Lone Ranger. It has to do with my maternal instinct. Is there such a thing? I think yes. Probably hormonal. I have not felt my old self for some weeks now, but it's very hard to separate the changes caused by my pregnancy from the changes caused by the terrible disaster which has overtaken the world. But there is a certain jealous feeling. Jealousy isn't really the right word, but it's the closest I can seem to come to the right word tonight. A feeling that you have moved a little closer to the center of the universe and must protect your position there. That's why the Varinol seems a greater risk than the bad dreams, although my rational mind believes that Varinol would not hurt the baby at all, not at least at the low levels the others have been maintaining. I suppose that jealous feeling is also a part of the love I feel for Stu Redman. I feel I am loving as well as eating for two. Otherwise, I must be quick. I need my sleep. No matter what dreams may come. We haven't made it all the way across Indiana as quickly as we had hoped. A horrible clog of vehicles near the Elkhart interchange slowed us down. A good many of the vehicles were army. There were dead soldiers. Glenn, Susan, Stern, Dana, and Stu took as much firepower as they could find, about 2 dozen rifles, some grenades, and, yes, folks, it's true, a rocket launcher. As I write now, Harold and Stu are trying to figure out the rocket launcher, for which there are 17 or 18 rockets. Please God they don't blow themselves up.
Speaking of Harold, I must tell you, dear diary, that he doesn't suspect a thing.
Sounds like a line from an old Betty Davis movie, doesn't it?
When we catch up with Mother Abigail's party, I suppose he will have to be told. It would not be fair to hide it any longer, come what may. But today he was brighter and more cheerful than I have ever seen him. He grinned so much I thought his face would crack. He was the one who suggested Stu help him with that dangerous rocket launcher, and... But here they come back now. We'll finish later.
Franny slept heavily and dreamlessly. So did they all, with the exception of Harold Lauder. Sometime shortly after midnight, he rose and walked softly to where Franny lay and stood looking down at her. He was not smiling now, although he had smiled all day. At times he had felt that the smile would crack his face right up the middle and spill out his whirling brains. That might have been a relief. He stood looking down at her, listening to the chirr of summer crickets. "We're in dog days now," he thought. "Dog days, from July the 25th to August 28th, according to Webster's, so named because rabid dogs were supposed to be the most common then." He looked down at Fran, sleeping so sweetly, using her sweater for a pillow. Her pack was beside her.
"Every dog has his day, Franny."
He knelt, freezing at the gunshots of his bending knees, but no one stirred. He unbuckled her pack, untied the drawstring, and reached inside. He trained a small pencil flash on the pack's contents. Franny muttered from deep down in sleep, stirred, and Harold held his breath. He found what he wanted way at the bottom, behind three clean blouses and a lap-eared pocket road atlas, a spiral notebook. He pulled it out, opened to the first page, and shone his light on Franny's close but extremely legible handwriting. July 6, 1990. After some persuasion, Mr. Bateman has agreed to come along with us. Harold shut the book and crept back to his sleeping bag with it. He was feeling like the little boy he had once been, the boy with few friends. He had enjoyed a brief period of babyhood beauty until about age 3, had been a fat and ugly joke ever since. But many enemies, the boy who had been more or less taken for granted by his parents, their eyes had been trained on Amy as she began her long walk down the Miss America Atlantic City runway of her life. The boy who had turned to books for solace, the boy who had escaped never being picked for baseball or always being passed over for school patrol boy by becoming Long John Silver, or Tarzan, or Philip Kent. The boy who had become these people late at night under his covers with a flashlight trained on the printed page, his eyes wide with excitement, barely smelling his own bed farts. This boy now crawled upside down to the bottom of his sleeping bag with Franny's diary and his flashlight. As he trained its beam on the front cover of the spiral, there was a moment of sanity. For just a moment, part of his mind cried out, "Harold, stop!" so strongly that he was shaken to his heels. And stop he almost did. For just a moment it seemed possible to stop, to put the diary back where he had found it, to give her up, to let them go their own way before something terrible and irrevocable happened. For that moment it seemed he could put the bitter drink away, pour it out of the cup, and refill it with whatever there was for him in this world. "Give it over, Harold," this sane voice begged, but maybe it was already too late. At age 16 he had given up Burroughs and Stevenson and Robert Howard in favor of other fantasies, fantasies that were both well-loved and much hated. Not of rockets or pirates, but of girls in silk see-through pajamas, kneeling before him on satin pillows, while Harold the Great lolled naked on his throne, ready to chastise them with small leather whips, with silver-headed canes. They were bitter fantasies through which every pretty girl at Agunquit High School had strolled at one time or another. These daydreams always ended with a gathering expletive in his loins, an explosion of seminal fluid that was more curse than pleasure. And then he would sleep, the sperm drying to a scale on his belly. Every doggie has his day. And now, it was those bitter fantasies, the old hurts that he gathered around him like yellowed sheets, the old friends who never died, whose teeth never dulled, whose deadly affection never wavered. He turned to that first page, trained his flashlight on the words, and began to read. In the hour before dawn, he replaced the diary in Fran's pack and secured the buckles. He took no special precautions. If she woke, he thought coldly, he would kill her and then run. Run where? West. But he would not stop in Nebraska, or even in Colorado. Oh, no. She didn't wake. He went back to his sleeping bag. He masturbated bitterly. When sleep came, it was thin. He dreamed he was dying halfway down a steep grade of tumbled rocks and moonscape boulders. High above, riding the night thermals, were cruising buzzards, waiting for him to make them a meal. There was no moon, no stars. And then a frightful red eye opened in the dark. Vulpin, eldritch. The eye terrified him, yet held him. The eye beckoned him. To the west, where the shadows were even now gathering in their twilight dance of death. When they made camp at sundown that evening, they were west of Joliet, Illinois. There was a case of beer, good talk, laughter. They felt they had put the rain behind them with Indiana. Everyone remarked specially on Harold, who had never been so cheerful. "You know, Harold," Franny said later that evening as the party began to break up, "I don't think I've ever seen you feeling so good. What is it?" He gave her a jolly wink. "Every dog has his day, Fran." She smiled back at him, a little puzzled. But she supposed it was just Harold being elliptical. It didn't matter. What mattered was that things were finally coming right. That night, Harold began his own journal. Chapter 48. He came staggering and flapping up a long upgrade, the heat of the sun stewing his stomach and baking his brains. The interstate shimmered with reflected radiant heat. He had been Donald Merwin Elbert once. Now he was Trash Can Man forever and ever, and he beheld the fabled city, 7-in-1, Cibola. How long had he been traveling west? How long since the kid? God might know. Trash Can Man did not. It had been days. Nights. Oh, he remembered the nights. He stood, swaying in his rags, looking down at Cibola, the city that is promised, the city of dreams. He was a wreck. The wrist that he had broken when he leaped the railing of the stairway bolted to the cheery oil tank had not healed right, and that wrist was a grotesque lump wrapped in a dirty, unraveling ace bandage. All the bones in the fingers of that hand had pulled up somehow, turning the hand into a Quasimodo claw. His left arm was a slowly healing mass of burn tissue from elbow to shoulder. It no longer smelled bad and suppurated, but the new flesh was hairless and pink, like the skin of a cheap doll. His grinning, mad face was sunburned, peeling, scruffy-bearded, and covered with scabs from the header he had taken when the front wheel of his bike had parted company from the frame. He wore a faded blue J.C. Penney work shirt that was marked with expanding rings of sweat stain and a dirty pair of corduroy trousers. His pack, which had been new not so long ago, had now taken on the style and substance of its owner. One strap had broken. Trash had knotted it as best he could, and the pack now hung askew on his back like a shutter on a haunted house. It was dusty, its creases filled with desert sand. On his feet were keds, now bound together with hanks of twine, and from them his scratched and sand-chafed ankles rose innocent of socks. He stared at the city far ahead and below. He turned his face up to the savage gunmetal sky and to the sun that blared down, coating him with furnace heat. He screamed. It was a savage, triumphant scream, very much like the one Susan Stern had uttered when she split Roger Rabbit's skull with the butt of his own shotgun. He began to do a shuffling, victorious dance on the hot, shimmering surface of Interstate 15, while the desert Sirocco blew sand across the highway, and the blue peaks of the Paranagat and Spotted Ranges sawed their teeth indifferently at the brilliant sky as they had done for millennia. Off the other side of the highway, a Lincoln Continental and a T-Bird were now almost buried in sand, their occupants mummified behind safety glass. Up ahead on Trash Can's side was an overturned pickup, everything covered but the wheels and the rocker panels. He danced. His feet, clad in the lashed and bulging keds, bumped up and down on the highway in a drunken sort of hornpipe. The tattered tail of his shirt flapped. His canteen clunked against his pack. The unraveling ends of the ace bandage fluttered in the hot breath of the wind. Pink smooth burn tissue gleamed rawly. Clock springs of veins bulged at his temples. He had been in God's frying pan for a week now, moving southwest across Utah, the tip of Arizona, and then into Nevada, and he was just as mad as a hatter. As he danced, he sang monotonously, the same words over and over, to a tune that had been popular when he was in the Terre Haute Institution, a song called Down to the Nightclub that had been done by a black group called Tower of Power. But the words were his own. He sang,
Siabala, siabala, bump-de-bump-de-bump, siabala, siabala, bump-de-bump-de-bump.
Each final bump was followed by a little skipping leap until the heat made everything swim and the harsh bright sky went twilight gray, and he collapsed on the road, half-fainting, his taxed heart thundering crazily in his arid chest. With the last of his strength, blubbering and grinning, he pulled himself over the overturned pickup truck and lay in its diminishing shade, shivering in the heat and panting.
Sibala, he croaked. Bump-de-bump-de-bump.
He fumbled his canteen off his shoulder with his claw hand and shook it. The canteen was nearly empty. Didn't matter. He would drink every single drop and lay up here until the sun went down, and then he would walk down the highway and into Sibala. Fabled city, 7-in-1. Tonight he would drink from the ever-springing fountains faced in gold. But not until the killer sun went down. God was the greatest firebug of them all. A long time ago, a boy named Donald Merwin Elbert had burned up Old Lady Semple's pension check. That same boy had torched the Methodist Church in Poutonville, and if there had been anything left of Donald Merwin Elbert in this shell, it had surely been cremated with the oil tanks in Gary, Indiana. Over 9 dozen of them, and they had gone up like a walloping string of firecrackers. Just in time for the 4th of July, too. Nice. And in the wake of that conflagration, only the trash can man had been left, his left arm a cracked and boiling stew, a fire inside his body that was never going to go out, at least not until his body was so much blackened charcoal. And tonight he would drink the water of Sibala. Yes. And it would taste like wine. He upended the canteen, and his throat worked as the last of his water, piss-warm, gurgled down into his belly. When it was gone, he threw the canteen out into the desert. Sweat had broken on his forehead like dew. He lay shivering deliciously with water cramps.
Sibala, he muttered. Sibala, I'm coming. I'm coming. I'll do whatever you want. My life for you. Bump-de-bump-de-bump.
Drowsiness began to steal over him now that his thirst was a little slaked. He was nearly asleep when a polar thought slipped up through the floor of his mind like an icy stiletto blade. What if Sibala had been a mirage?
No, he muttered. No. No.
But simple denial would not drive the thought off. The blade probed and poked, keeping sleep at arm's length. What if he had drunk the last of his water in celebration of a mirage? In his own way, he recognized his madness, and that was the sort of thing mad people did, right enough. If it had been a mirage, he would die here in the desert, and the buzzards would dine on him. At last, unable to bear the hideous possibility any longer, he staggered to his feet and made his way back to the road, fighting off the waves of faintness and nausea that wanted to take him down. At the breast of the hill he stared out anxiously into the long flat plain below, studded with yucca and tumbleweed and devil's mantilla. His breath caught in his throat and unraveled into a sigh, like a sleeve of fabric on a spike. It was there. Sibala, fabled of old, searched for by many, found by the trash-can man. Far down in the desert, surrounded by blue mountains, blue itself in the haze of distance, its towers and avenues gleamed in the desert day. There were palm trees, he could see palm trees, and movement, and water.
Oh, Cibola,
he crooned, and staggered back to the shade of the pickup. It was farther than it looked, he knew that. Tonight, after God's torch had left the sky, he would walk as he never had before. He would reach Cibola, and his first act would be to plunge headlong into the first fountain he came to. Then he would find him, the man who had bade him come here. The man who had drawn him across the plains and the mountains and finally into the desert, all in a month's time, and despite his horribly burned arm. He who is the dark man, the hard case. He waited for Trash Can Man in Cibola, and his were the armies of the night. His were the white-faced riders of the dead, who would sweep out of the west and into the very face of the rising sun. They would come raving and grinning and stinking of sweat and gunpowder. There would be shrieks, and Trash Can cared very little for shrieks. There would be rape and subjugation, things about which he cared even less. There would be murder, which was immaterial. And there would be a great burning. About that he cared very much. In the dreams, the dark man came to him and spread out his arms from a high place and showed Trash Can a country in flames, cities going up like bombs, cultivated fields drawn in lines of fire, the very rivers of Chicago and Pittsburgh and Detroit and Birmingham ablaze with floating oil. And the dark man had told him a very simple thing in his dreams, a thing which had brought him running. I will set you high in my artillery. You are the man I want. He rolled on his side, his cheeks and eyelids chafed and irritated from the blowing sand. He had been losing hope. Yes, ever since the wheel had fallen off his bike, he had been losing hope. God, the God of father-killing sheriffs, the God of Carly Yates, was stronger than the dark man after all, it seemed. Yet he had kept his faith and had kept on. And at last, when it seemed he was going to burn up in this desert before he ever got to Cibola, where the dark man waited, he had seen it far below, dreaming in the sun. Cibola, he whispered, and slept. The first dream had come to him in Gary over a month ago, after he had burned his arm. He had gone to sleep that night sure that he was going to die. No one could be burned as badly as he was and live. A refrain had beaten its way into his head. Live by the torch, die by the torch. Live by it, die by it. His legs had given out in a small city park, and he had fallen down, his left arm sprawled out and away from him like a dead thing. The shirt sleeves smoked off. The pain was giant, incredible. He had never dreamed there could be such pain in the world. He had been running gleefully from one set of oil tanks to the next, setting up crude timing devices, each constructed of a steel pipe and a flammable paraffin mixture separated from a little pool of acid by a steel tab. He had been pushing these devices into the outflow pipes on top of the tanks. When the acid ate through the steel, the paraffin would ignite, and that would cause the tanks to blow. He had planned to get over to the west side of Gary, near the confusion of interchanges leading various roads toward Chicago or Milwaukee, before any of them blew. He wanted to watch the show as the entire dirty city went up in a firestorm. But he had misjudged the last device or constructed it badly. It had gone off while he worked at opening the cap on the outflow with a pipe wrench. There had been a blinding white flare as burning paraffin belched out of the tube, coating his left arm with fire. This was no painless flame glove of lighter fluid to be waved in the air and then shaken out like a big match. This was agony, like having your arm in a volcano. Shrieking, he had run wildly around the top of the oil tank, careering off the waist-high railings like a human pinball. If the railings had not been there, he would have plunged over the side and fallen, turning over and over, like a torch dropped down a well. Only accident saved his life. His feet tangled in each other, and he fell with his left arm pinned under him, smothering the flames. He sat up, still half crazy with the pain. Later he would think that only blind luck, or the dark man's purpose, had saved him from being burned to death. Most of the paraffin jet had missed him, so he was thankful. But his thankfulness only came later. At the time he could only cry out and rock back and forth, holding his crisped arm out from his body as the skin smoked and crackled and contracted.
Vaguely, as the light faded from the sky, it occurred to him that he had already set a dozen of the time devices. They might go any time. Dying and being out of his exquisite misery would be wonderful. Dying in flames would be utter horror. Somehow he had crawled down from the tank and had staggered away, weaving and lunging in and out of the dead traffic, holding his barbecued left arm away from his body. By the time he reached a small park near the center of town, it was sunset. He sat on the grass between two shuffleboard courts, trying to think what you did for burns. Put butter on them. That's what Donald Merwin Elbert's mother would have said. But that was for a scald, or when the bacon fat jumped extra high and spattered you with hot grease. He couldn't imagine putting butter on the cracked and blackened mess between his elbow and shoulder. Couldn't even imagine touching it. Kill himself. That was it. That was the ticket. He would put himself out of his misery like an old dog. There was a sudden gigantic explosion on the east side of town, as if the fabric of existence had been torn briskly in two. A liquid pillar of fire shot up against dusk's deepening indigo. He had to squeeze his eyes to watering, protesting slits against it. Even in his agony, the fire pleased him. More, it delighted, fulfilled him. The fire was the best medicine, even better than the morphine he found the next day. As a trustee in prison, he had worked in the infirmary as well as the library and the motor pool, and he knew about morphine and Elleville and Darvon complex. He did not connect his present agony to the pillar of fire. He only knew that the fire was good, the fire was beautiful, the fire was something he needed and would always need. Wonderful fire. Moments later, a second oil tank exploded, and even here, 3 miles away, he could feel the warm push of expanding air. Another tank went, and another. A slight pause, and then 6 of them went up in a rattling string, and now it was too bright over there to look at, but he looked anyway, grinning, his eyes full of yellow flames, his wounded arm forgotten, thoughts of suicide forgotten. It took better than 2 hours for all of them to go up, and by then dark had fallen, but it wasn't dark. The night was yellow and orange and feverish with flames. The entire eastern arc of the horizon danced with fire. It reminded him of a classic funny book he had owned as a child, an adaptation of H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds. Now, years later, the boy who had owned that funny book was gone, but the trash can man was here, and trash owned the wonderful, terrible secret of the Martian's death ray. It was time to leave the park. Already the temperature had risen 10 degrees. He ought to go west, stay ahead of the fire the way he had in Poutonville, racing the expanding arc of destruction. But he was in no condition to race. So he fell asleep on the grass, and the firelight played over the face of a tired, ill-used child. In his dream, the dark man came in his hooded robe, his face invisible. Yet the trash can man thought he had seen this man before. When the loungers in the candy store and the beer parlor back in Poutonville catcalled at him, it seemed that this man had been among them, silent and thoughtful. When he had worked at the scrub-a-dubba, soap the headlights, knock the wipers, soap the rocker panels, hey mister, you want hot wax on that? Wearing the sponge glove on his right hand until the hand beneath looked like a pale dead fish, the nails as white as fresh ivory. It seemed he had seen this man's face, fiery and grinning with lunatic joy from beneath the rippling film of water rolling down the windshield. When the sheriff had sent him away to the nuthatch in Terre Haute, he had been the grinning psych aide standing above his head in the room where they gave you the shocks, his hands on the controls. "I'm gonna fry your brains out, boy, help you on your way as you change from Donald Merwin Elbert into the trash can man. Would you like hot wax on that?" Ready to send about 1,000 volts zizzing into his brain. He knew this dark man, all right. His was the face you could never quite see. His the hands which dealt all spades from a dead deck. His the eyes beyond the flames. His the grin from beyond the grave of the world. "I'll do whatever you want," he said gratefully in the dream. "My life for you." The dark man had lifted his arms inside his robe, turning the robe into the shape of a black kite. They stood on a high place, and below them America lay in flames. "I will set you high in my artillery. You are the man I want."
Then he saw an army of 10,000 raggle-taggle cast-off men and women driving east, driving across the desert and into the mountains, a rough beast of an army whose time had come round at last. They loaded down trucks and jeeps and wagoneers and campers and tanks. Each man and woman wore a dark stone about his or her neck, and deep in some of those stones was a red shape that might have been an eye or might have been a key. And riding in their van atop a giant tanker with pillow tires, he saw himself and knew that the truck was filled with jellied napalm. And behind him, in column, were trucks loaded with pressure bombs and teller mines and plastic explosive, flamethrowers and flares and heat-seeking missiles, grenades and machine guns and rocket launchers. The dance of death was about to begin, and already the strings of the fiddles and guitars were smoking, and the stench of brimstone and cordite filled the air. The dark man lifted his arms again, and when he dropped them, everything was cold and silent. The fire's gone, even the ashes cold. And for just a moment he was only Donald Merwin Elbert again, small and afraid and confused. For just that moment he suspected he was just another pawn in the dark man's huge chess game, that he had been deceived. Then he saw the dark man's face was no longer entirely hidden. Two dark red coals burned in the sunken pits where his eyes should have been, and illuminated a nose as narrow as a blade. "I'll do whatever you want," Trash said gratefully in the dream. "My life for you, my soul for you." "I will set you to burn," the dark man said gravely. "You must come to my city, and there all will be made clear."
"Where? Where?"
He was in an agony of hope and expectation. "West," the dark man said, fading.
"West, beyond the mountains."
He woke up then, and it was still night and still bright. The flames were closer. The heat was stifling. Houses were exploding. The stars were gone, shrouded in a thick pall of oil smoke. A fine rain of soot had begun. The shuffleboard courts were dusted with black snow. Now that he had a purpose, he found he could walk. He limped west, and from time to time he saw a few others leaving Gary, looking back over their shoulders at the conflagration. "Fools," Trash thought almost affectionately. "You'll burn. In good time, you'll burn." They took no notice of him. To them, the trash can man was only another survivor. They disappeared into the smoke, and sometime after dawn, trash can man limped across the Illinois state line. Chicago was north of him, Joliet to the southwest, the fire lost in its own horizon-blotting smoke behind. That had been the dawn of July 2nd. He had forgotten his dreams of burning Chicago to the ground. His dreams of more oil tanks and freight cars full of LP gas tucked away on railroad sidings and the tinder-dry tenements. He didn't care a fig for the Windy City. That afternoon he broke into a Chicago Heights doctor's office and stole a case of morphine syrettes. The morphine drove back the pain a little, but it had a more important side effect. It made him care less about the pain he did feel. He took a huge jar of Vaseline from a drugstore that night and packed the burned part of his arm in an inch of the jelly. He was very thirsty. It seemed he wanted to drink all of the time. Fantasies of the dark man buzzed in and out of his mind like blowflies. When he collapsed at dusk, he had already begun to think that the city the dark man was directing him to must be Cibola, 7-in-1, the city that is promised. That night the dark man came to him again in his dreams, and with a sardonic giggle confirmed that this was so. Trash Can Man awoke from these confused dream memories of what had been to shivering desert cold. In the desert it was always ice or fire. There was no in-between. Moaning a little, he stood up, holding himself as close to himself as he could. Overhead a trillion stars gleamed, seeming almost close enough to touch, bathing the desert in their cold witch-light. He walked back to the road, wincing at his chafed and tender skin, and his many aches and pains. They were little to him now. He paused for a moment, looking down at the city, dreaming in the night. There were little sparks of light here and there, like electric campfires. Then he began to walk. When dawn began to color the sky hours later, Cibola seemed almost as distant as it had when he first came over the rise and saw it. and he had foolishly drunk all of his water, forgetting how magnified things looked out here. He didn't dare walk for long after sunrise because of the dehydration. He would have to lie up again before the sun rose.